open the Senate Revenue Committee. Would love to do this committee outdoors today. It's a beautiful spring day. Our lineup today is we will start with Senate Bill 871. We will follow that with Senate Bill 344 and then do 807. So if you're here for 807, and I don't see Louis, but if you're here, it'll
Louis's
probably be...
here. I just saw him in the halls.
Yeah. It'll probably be an hour.
Uncle Louis.
Uncle Louis.
Not
in
Uncle
the
Louis.
Building.
Not Aunt Louis.
Uncle Louis is here.
You're going to get us in trouble with the Italian-American.
Uncle Louis is in the building. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 871. We have someone. Paul, do we have someone on 871? I know we have testimony. Let's just go. We're going to launch right into this one. We're in a public hearing. So, Paul or Rob, do you want to come up and introduce us to the bill? Our staff is at lunch now and on their way.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rob Douglas, representing Diageo. Diageo is a premium drink business. They have a collection of beverage alcohol brands. They have spirits. They have wine. And they have beer. Brands include, but are not limited to, Johnny Walker, Guinness, Smirnoff, Smirnoff Ice, J&B, Bailey's, Jose Cuervo, Tanqueray, Captain Morgan, and Sterling Vineyard Wines. We are here today in support of Senate Bill 871. I appreciate the chance to discuss this bill in public hearing. This bill is occasioned by our belief that the Oregon Liquor Control Commission does not believe that flavored malt beverages fit the definition of malt beverage in Oregon statute. Believing this, we think that they are poised to send out a notice to distributors and retailers indicating that these beverages can no longer be sold in grocery stores. They've been sold in grocery stores for many years, and the purpose of this bill is to keep them in grocery stores. Mr. Chairman, we do not have a tremendous amount of pride of authorship in the draft of the bill. We understand other folks have amendments. We would welcome any version, any amendment that would have the effect of keeping these beverages in grocery stores. They are 4 to 5% alcohol by volume. They've traditionally been carried through that channel, and we would like that to continue. There is a bill on the House side, Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3097, which approaches this issue from a little different drafting standpoint, and that is a solution that we could also live with. Our concern, very frankly, Mr. Chairman, is that the federal government is going to change the standard for these beverages. We want to make sure that Oregon is not caught in a gap where you have beverages that no longer meet the definition of the OLCC for malt beverages and are removed from the store before the federal government decides what the future standard is going to be. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. So hypothetically, if the federal government, Rob, if they change, say, in 6 months or a year, they change the definition, we're out of session, but pass something that accomplished your goal, which is, regardless of the language, that achieves your goal of having the product on the shelves, would we be possibly one state out of 50 that actually has a different definition on our statutes for this product, and then the manufacturers, Diageo being one of them, would have to reformulate to Oregon as one of, and do 49 states differently?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's a very good question. That is what we're asking, is some sort of uniform standard. The federal definition does not automatically just flow through to the state. If that was true, we wouldn't be before you today, because we believe we meet the current federal standard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sir
Hannah. Yeah. Mr. Douglas, did OLCC, when they created this, was this by administrative rule, or was this by an interpretation of the AG that this did not meet this criteria, so therefore they were no longer available in package stores?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon, I do not believe they went through the administrative rule process. We found out the agency was poised to send out this directive. We had a chance to comment during a public portion of one of their commission meetings, and we're pleased to say the agency hasn't taken that step yet. They have not sent out the letter yet. But I do think, and not to speak for the agency, I do think they feel they're legally bound by the current definition of malt beverage, and that creates the problem.
Well, if I can, Mr. Chairman, to follow up on the chairman's question, will this put us in the same restrictive definition that other states follow by having this statutory language versus OLCC administratively taking different action? In other words, if we adopt this bill and OLCC determines, well, this isn't quite what they intended, this is what we intend to do by administrative rule, then where are we? Are we achieving what we're setting out to try to achieve on the language of this bill, or are we potentially at a loggerhead?
Potentially at loggerheads, and that's why the House bill I brought you may be a better solution, because basically what that does is hold in abeyance any change of what's going on now until the feds have a chance to adopt the standard. We don't think the feds are going to move overnight on this. Having watched the federal government and their notice of rulemaking and how long that takes, the public comment period, we think it's going to be a while.
Well, when would you estimate the Fed, if you had a guess?
Mr. Chairman, we have a witness later on the agenda who could really probably speak to the national situation better than I could.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Ringa. Hi, thank you for testifying this afternoon. I wanted to ask about the consumption of these drinks, and I'm looking at something from printed testimony of panel Erickson, Oregon Coalition to Reduce Underage Drinking, that implies that these products are really designed for teens, and I'm just wondering if you could comment on that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, I understand that is a concern on some parties. The federal government has actually taken a look at this issue. There's a piece of correspondence from the Federal Trade Commission we supplied Senator Hannon with yesterday, and I think the rest of the committee will have that for the hearing as well. Their investigation instead indicated that was not the case.
Their conclusion was that there was not, a disproportionate amount of consumption by teens? Is that
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, not targeted to teens.
I see. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Was there anything, was a part of the study directed to studying the consumption by teens?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, you have me at a disadvantage. We do have a witness who could talk about the national situation a little bit better. I frankly don't know the answer to that.
Okay, and just one more, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Rob, I remember when you met with me, you stated that if these are not sold in grocery stores, they essentially would go away. I mean, you wouldn't find another place to sell them. And I've been thinking about that, and I was wondering, why would it not work to sell them in a liquor store?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, we've seen no interest on the behalf of liquor stores to have these beverages in their stores. Again, they're 4 to 5% alcohol by volume, mm-hmm. as opposed to their current products. We just haven't seen any inclination whatsoever.
Okay. Thank you.
And you can stick around. We might have you come back right at the very end.
You bet.
Thanks, Mr. Douglas. Joe Gilliam and Paul Romaine. Let's have two an unlikely pair come together. Oh, Billy.
Gave him an extra seat between us, and he still wants to sit by me.
Just in the presence of greatness, sir.
Afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good, good.
For the record, Joe Gilliam, representing the Oregon Grocery Association. We have been undetermined on this bill, of all things, trying to clarify just what the current authority is of OLCC and what we might do to keep these on the shelf. Our objective is to keep the status quo of the products that are on the shelf today and keep them on the shelf tomorrow. And in that process, in trying to kind of wade through all the muck involved with this issue, what we're finding is we basically have an alcohol that's not really defined under the statute. So there's a lot of guessing on whether, where do you put it, how do you enforce it, who can rule over it, who has authority, who doesn't. So we've gone through a process, and we're hoping today that we get some answers to some basic questions to determine whether we really need legislation or not, and hope we get some something on the record that will help us guide us through. The bottom of my testimony is really the process we think that needs to be gone through in order to ascertain whether they need legislation. And the first is, and I believe Mr. Douglas just commented, maybe he answered it, is the federal guideline from the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, is that a mandate or a guideline? If it's a mandate, you don't need any legislation. You just follow what they say. If it's a guideline, we move on to the next question. Can the state standard of the amount for spirit-based flavorings be the same as the federal? Can we tie it in legislation to that federal standard? If we can, I think that's a great solution. You should pass that bill. If you can't, you need to determine what the current authority of OLCC is. Do they have authority to ban products that are at or below the 0.05 limit for an alcoholic beverage in the current statute? Currently, any beverage, whether it's a glass of water and you pour vodka into it, if it's 0.05 or less, it's not considered to be an alcoholic beverage. If it exceeds that 0.05, then you qualify under the statute that now you're an alcoholic beverage and you are under the authority of OLCC. So for any alternative beverage that has 0.05 or less, do they have the authority to ban that off the shelf? And I think you need to answer that question. If they do, I think you need legislation to keep it on the shelf. If they don't have the authority, you need to ask by rule, to Senator Hannah's question, by rule, can they set a different standard than the 0.05? And if the answer is yes, they can by rule, then do it by rule. If they can't, I think you then need to ask the question, do you have the right in a statute to set a standard above the 0.05, the 90-10 split? And if you do have that, I'd say you'd move on to the next question and say, pass legislation to do that based on what the status quo is today, not necessarily just to open it wide open, but to, based on the facts you determine today. So those are lists to go through for us to, you know, to really, I hope it's helpful to the committee to try to determine on these checkpoints which way we go. And without doing that, I don't think you get to a very good answer on how you're going to regulate these and how you're going to control them and make sure they're under the all the proper rules. I'm hoping that maybe legislative council can comment on some of this and the department itself would comment, but we've had mixed messages from the department on this of what their authority is. So it's kind of hard to get started on this without them coming down and saying.
We're going to have them testify. Have we heard from you? Have not heard from council in terms of our ability to link to the federal legislation?
I have not heard from council on that matter.
So if council's listening, if we have the ability, it would be nice to at least get a clear where we're at in terms of our ability to link to the federal legislation.
Yeah. My understanding right now is it's a constitutional issue. We can't tie a statute to a federal standard, but I don't know if that's all been fleshed out. Is there any way for us to tie and float with them? Our concern is the one you brought up earlier. We can live with the 90-10 standard if everybody's on the 90-10 standard, but in a 1% grocery market, if we're the only state with the lowest brewing level, we're not sure we're going to have all the products we have today because it may not make financial sense to be in the state.
Yeah, I've never seen Oregon to be an outlier, and I don't know, we'll hear Mr. Douglas or whoever you have can come and testify last to this, but having us as an outlier just does not seem to me practical.
And we would agree with that, Mr. Chair.
So who is our counselor? I know Paul just left.
Dave Hendricks.
Yeah. Davis.
Okay. I believe it's Dave Hendricks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. I'm going to give you a little bit of my background. In 1975, I was in the Legislative Council office for the first session. I, along with Senator Hannon, were a little older, just a little bit. In 1977, I was in the Attorney General's office. I was the Chief Deputy Attorney General for the state of Oregon from 77 to 78. I was special counsel to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. My practice since 1970, end of 78, on has been focused mainly upon liquor law. Let me kind of give you a little bit of background. First of all, the federal standard for what this alcohol is for federal purposes only. That's tax. In other words, how is this going to be taxed? Is it going to be taxed as distilled spirits? Is it going to be taxed as beer? Is it going to be taxed as wine? There are different tax rates. Under the 21st Amendment, each state controls what it determines for distribution purposes will be distributed within the state. So no matter what the feds do, you, under the 21st Amendment, have the right to determine what it is that's distributed in this state and how it's distributed. For example, you, a long time ago, said that distilled spirits will only be distributed in certain stores. You don't have to do that. That's not mandated by the federal government, but it's up to you to decide. So you determine where this product, no matter what the feds do, where it will be. Second of all, you can't tie to a future federal definition. You have to tie to whatever is in effect today. There's a controversy at the federal level, and I'll get to that in a second, but basically there's sort of a void at the federal level over what this particular animal is. Is it a mammal? Is it a fish? What is it? They're trying to determine that. Let me back up. A couple years ago, you had a similar issue to this. You basically had sort of low-alcohol distilled spirit drinks in grocery stores issues, and you decided not to take any action on it. After last session, actually it was about a little more than a year ago, all of a sudden some publicity came out about, basically the last couple years, this product like Smirnoff Ice and Sky Blue and all this stuff started coming out there, and we in the distribution industry were told, this is just beer. It's just flavored beer. And so and that makes it legal under Oregon law to put it in grocery stores. So we put it in all the grocery stores, and we worked with our grocery partners, and we put it out there. And all of a sudden, one of the brands started advertising, contains vodka. And there was a big controversy over that because it can't contain vodka. Then they started saying, well, it really contains the flavor of vodka. So we're sitting there going, wait a second, vodka's flavorless, so what is this stuff? So people started asking questions about this product. What is this product? Is it fish or fowl? And it was very interesting. Texas Alcohol Beverage Commission, March, right in there, had a meeting where a number of the folks in the BATF, which has been the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which is now the Tax and Trade Bureau, or the TTB, get confused with these definitions, came down to Texas. The number of commissioners from around the country, a few state executives like myself, attorneys who practice, people representing Diageo and other companies involved in this, the beer companies, everybody, all the stakeholders came down there. Everybody was trying to figure out, what is this particular product? And we went through all types of gyrations on it. People were saying basically what the product is there's a base that's made from fermented grain. Fermented grain is beer. Fermented grain, that's how you get beer. It's a base. Now, added to that base is flavoring to get it to what it tastes like today. However, the flavoring is basically distilled spirits. Now, at this meeting, we were going through all types of religious arguments of, is this trans transposed or, you know, transfigured from one thing to the next because it's flavoring and it's exempt from tax, but now it becomes a potable so you can drink it. So is it really distilled spirits or is it flavoring? Is it something different? The bottom line was I asked the question of Art Libertucci from BATF, if you had a glass of water and you poured enough of this flavoring in it so that it tasted like whatever you wanted it to taste like, and it was now 5% alcohol, what would you call it? He'd say, call it a distilled spirit. Well, this prompted some interest in state regulators and BATF, and BATF basically did a study of about 114 of these particular products to find out what was in this product, alcohol-wise. Most of these products are less than 5% alcohol, total volume. However, what they found was that about 105, 107 of the products that were out there were really somewhere between 70 and 95% distilled spirits. So that's why you have this controversy raging. In the summer, BATF came up and said that they were going to propose a federal definition of 90-10. Okay, that was the initial hit. That they looked like they were looking at this thing. That was where the staff wanted to go, but they were going to study it further, and they asked for industry input. That was in the summer. The politics began. 90-10 basically is conforms with what Oregon law is today. Oregon law right now, in my opinion, and the opinion of the Attorney General, says that, in effect, it's malt beverage if it's fermented grain. And there's no provision in Oregon law for the fortification, if you would, of fermented grain. So you can't add anything to that. And if it's over 0.5% alcohol by volume, it can't be added to beer, in effect. So we went through this thing, 90-10 at the federal level. Politics were played. There were rumors at various stages of are the feds really going to go to a 51-49 where 51% of the alcohol could be from fermented grain, the rest of it could be from any other source, distilled spirits. There was a rumor that Diageo was winning the political battle, then the beer companies were winning the political battle. It was back and forth. A few weeks ago, the federal government basically came out with a proposed regulation which says pretty much conforms to what you have in Oregon today. In other words, 90% of the alcohol has to be from fermented grain, beer. You can add up to 10% of flavoring, alcohol from flavoring. The battle right now is over who's going to sort of formulate these kind of drinks. That's really what it amounts to. I mean, some of the spirit companies want more distilled spirits in it. The beer companies want less distilled spirits in it. We in the distributor community do not believe you need a bill. We do not think you should have 871. We believe, and this was a very interesting meeting we had a few weeks ago, we don't like this. It was passed to us as beer. It's not beer. It's distilled spirits. And we have a problem with that. So we would ask for you to basically say that beer is beer. That's what, in Oregon, we define beer as. If you want to distribute something through the beer channels in Oregon, then you make it beer. If it's not, you distribute it as all other distilled spirits are distributed through the liquor stores. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Yep.
Ms. Erickson, I'm going to get this wrong. Ms. Strom? Stromdig. Oh, boy, she has a suitcase. It's not a good sign. What's the product itself?
Mr. Yeah. Chairman?
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
did you bring a bottle opener today?
I understand the bottom works here.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, they're with
Can I put these up here for you?
Oh, they are the product itself. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, but are they cold?
They are.
There you are.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Pamela Erickson. I'm the director of the Coalition to Reduce Underage Drinking. We're a nonprofit organization that supports good public policies that are designed to reduce underage drinking. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify about this issue. We have two primary problems with this product. The first is its appeal to young kids. I have some examples here. These products don't look like beer. They don't taste like beer. They actually resemble pop and are very attractive to kids. It masks the taste of alcohol. Most adults aren't familiar with these products, but kids are. A recent study of radio advertising found that kids were 12% more likely to have heard ads about these products than adults. These products are, to some degree, developed for the first-time drinker. And I think we need to think about who is the first-time drinker. Too often, it's a 12 or 13-year-old kid. It's shocking to realize that one out of four eighth graders reported drinking last month in this state. That's way too high. And these drinks often taste like pop. They mask the taste of alcohol. They go down a lot easier. They're also often very attractive to young women. So that's why we believe that these products need greater control. You have much greater control in our state liquor stores, and we believe that if you're going to carry these products, that's the place for them. The second issue is one of tax avoidance. Several months ago, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms completed a formulation of 114 of these products, and they found that most of them, the alcohol in the product was really distilled spirits. It was not malt. Basically, what you do is you take the malt base out, you take the flavor out, the color out. Obviously, these don't look like beer. And you add in distilled spirits from a flavoring. And in answer to why would anybody do that, William Foster, a BATF deputy chief, had this to say. There are advantages both in tax and distribution channels for the manufacturers. The federal excise tax on a gallon of beer is 5% is 58 cents, while the excise tax on a gallon of spirits is $1.35. Beer is distributed in grocery and convenience stores in many states where spirits products are only available in spirits outlets. Lastly, spirits are not nationally advertised on television where beer is. And as you know, we have a very low beer tax in this state, so there's another major tax avoidance issue in this state. We don't have any particular comments on this bill or any other bill, how you attempt to solve the problem. Our issue is primarily with these products. We think they're attractive to kids, and we don't like the fact that they're taxed at the rate of beer. We believe that the best solution is to sell these products in our liquor stores. Thank you very much.
Question?
Yeah, Senator Farrelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would these products be listable as the state? In other words, could they currently legally be sold in a state liquor store?
To my knowledge, they would, but since I'm no longer there, but as far as I can see, they would be. You could list them.
It's my understanding, Mr. Chairman, that only products above 5% alcohol content can be sold in a state liquor store.
I'm sorry, Senator, could you please say that again?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that only products above 5% in alcohol can currently be listed and sold in a state liquor store.
Senator Farrelly, I don't recall exactly how the legislation is phrased. I believe that if it's over 0.5%, the state can have the exclusive right to sell it. I'm not sure. I'd have to go back and read the statute again. I think the problem is that there's no provision for selling anything under that limit. You can't sell it in a package or a convenience store.
Senator Hannon.
Mr. Chairman. Ms. Erickson, when you were at the OLCC, was there any attempt to regulate this type of sale?
Senator Hannon, when I was at the OLCC, we believed that these were indeed malt beverages. They say on their on the label that they're a malt beverage. Only until we got the formulation from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms did we realize that they were primarily distilled spirits, and we started looking at the statutes to see whether they could actually be sold in grocery and convenience stores. And there was a period of time where there's quite a bit of argument with lawyers, but I believe that the lawyer from the Liquor Commission has determined that these products under our current statutes can't be sold in our grocery or convenience stores. But, you know, when I left, they were still talking about it, so I think you need to ask them for their final determination.
My other question, Ms. Chairman, if I can, my other question is, when these products are sold in a grocery store, are they still subject to the being purchased by people over 21?
That's correct. They you still have to be at least 21 to purchase these products.
So if this type of alcohol is winding up in the hands of eighth graders, is it being placed there by 21-year-old people or 60-year-old people, or how is it achieving its position with eighth graders if they're supposed to be over 21 to buy it? And why would it be any different in a liquor store?
That's a good question, Senator Hannon. The general research on how kids get alcohol is that the younger the kid is, the more likely that they're going to get it from their own home, their parents' home, or from an older kid. As a kid gets older, they are more likely to buy it from a grocery or convenience store. The thing about the liquor store is you have to be 21 to go in. So that's a pretty intimidating notion for a lot of kids. They just won't go into the liquor store.
Well, then I think we need more aggressive laws on handling grocery store business if they're marketing this product to eighth graders. I would submit that maybe we have a problem with the marketing problem with the stores rather than the product. The second thing I would ask you is that tobacco is regulated also, and tobacco is also used by young people. And we've tried to regulate tobacco, and we've tried to outlaw tobacco, and we've tried to prevent people from smoking in certain areas, and we've tried to regulate the use of tobacco. Using that same methodology on this type of spirits, are we then to assume that only this type of product will be sold in a liquor store, but yet the advertisement will still continue, and yet the attractiveness of a minor is still to the product, regardless whether it's in a grocery store or a liquor store? Same way tobacco. It's still marketed, it's still advertised, it's still sold, and it's still used. But somebody is providing it to eighth graders. I mean, it's just not arbitrarily handing it out to eighth graders at the principal's office.
Mm-hmm. Senator Hannon, the strategy to reduce underage drinking of this product would be the same as any other product, which is frequent compliance checks, work with parents to make sure they aren't furnishing their child. And it's surprising how many parents actually will furnish alcohol to their children. Work with schools, work with local communities to interdict underage parties. All of those things are equally effective for all alcohol products.
Thank you. Thank you,
Ms. Erickson, and I guess I have some kind of a similar question. Do we have evidence that two of your assertions were that this product is marketed to eighth graders and primarily to young women or young girls? Do we have evidence of that? I know that we're going to have contrary evidence or study.
Senator Decker, I guess I would not say that. I don't believe there's any evidence that a company looks specifically at an underage cohort and said, let's advertise to those kids. I think what they do is they're not very careful. We have a youth-oriented culture, and advertisements are really attractive to young people in the kind of general sense. You'd be shocked at some of the advertisements that you see. I went onto a website, it wasn't one of these products, and saw an advertisement for a group sex party. They get that bad. This is an industry that is just not very careful. For one of these products.
I mean, I guess that's my curiosity is that if that's the case, then we have a problem. If we have direct marketing, I mean, and the assertion was made, and I guess it's just important that we get evidence that that is the case. And today's just a hearing, but if they're able to, and I know one of the future testimonies is going to attempt to do this, provide evidence that that is not the case, I think it's incumbent upon especially your organization or others to show us that that indeed is false.
Senator Decker, there is a major study going on at Georgetown University that looks at a whole series of different advertising. And what they do is identify how often that advertising hits kids versus adults. And it's a matter of picking your markets, picking a radio station that's primarily adults and not primarily children. And what they have found was that the wine industry is very good at it. They really do target their product to adults. It is possible to do that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Heather? Thank you.
Stromberg, thank you. Well, and I might say that some of these products have been advertised on other stations other than like NBC, ABC, and CBS. I don't know how many of you watch Buffy the Vampire. Some of these products are advertised there, and so kids do see them. I mean, I'm not one that watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but I had to do that because I found out that that's where they were being advertised. So kids do get messages. They get messages off the Internet, from TV, magazines, radio, all of it. And these are easy to drink, so it's a dilemma. I come today as by the way, Kathy Stromberg. I come as a parent, a grandparent, a board member for MAD. I'm a victims advocate for them. I sit on the board of the Oregon Coalition to Reduce Underage Drinking. I sit on the DUI Multnomah County Advisory Board. I am totally entrenched in trying to look at ways to reduce underage drinking. I also work with parents and families, and parents have a huge responsibility just raising their children. I don't know how many of you are parents. It's a big job. When they are bombarded with this extra issue of advertising product that kids like because it tastes good, it's an issue. So I think that we need to help parents to try to eliminate ways that their kids can access products such as these. I can't fight with anybody about whether or not they should be in liquor stores or in grocery stores. My issue is with the product itself. These are things that kids, young women, love these drinks because they're easy to consume. Guys love beer. Girls love these things. They start at very early ages. I have a sixth grade daughter. Our granddaughter, and they are drinking this at the sixth grade level. And yeah, it has to do with advertising. It has to do with parents. It has to do with a lot of things. I think what we need to do as a society is being responsible. We need to be responsible in our alcohol consumption as role models, as how we market products, about what we present. We don't do a very good job of all of this. And unless we do that, we are going to lose our greatest asset, which is our youth. I probably could ask every one of you if you know somebody or you have a family member that has ever been impacted by alcohol, whether it be at a young age, a middle age, or an older age, and you'd all probably say yes. It seems to me that we as a society are more interested in selling alcohol or drinking alcohol than we are in trying to find ways where we can limit some of this or making money around it. And so I just think we need to be more responsible. And whatever you do with these as far as selling them in a grocery store or selling them in a liquor store, we just need to really pay attention to what's going on because otherwise it's going to slip right through and we're going to have another issue on our hands. Thank you.
Thank you for
coming down today. Questions, comments, Senator Ringo, before we're losing our...
You know, I just want to ask you, thank you, Mr. Chair, whether you have any objective data about children and their consuming these drinks.
An objective data? They shouldn't.
No. Whether you have data as to...
Oh, data. Yes, we have lots of data. Personally...
And I apologize for missing the previous speaker. Maybe she presented some, but...
You mean as far as the number of kids that consume this? Yes, I believe that Pam did.
I think some of these products are just too new. I think we ask kids about consuming alcohol in general. To my knowledge, I don't have any data that says specifically what brands or what what types of products people drink. We could look and see if we can find some information if you're interested, Senator.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Senator.
I think it's easy to state generalities that kids drink these and advertisements mm-hmm. are focused towards them, but I would be more comfortable dealing with some hard facts.
And I think that in the youth surveys that we take with kids, they will ask them, we won't ask them for specific product, but we'll ask them, what have you consumed how many drinks you've consumed in the last 30 days? We will ask them that, but as far as the product, I don't know that they can get that specific. But I can definitely get you information on how many drinks you've consumed in the last 30 days, 60 days, or whatever. All of that stuff we can get you.
Okay, but that doesn't do it because it doesn't relate to those
right.
products.
Right, okay. And that could be difficult.
Okay, thank you.
But that's what we would need, I think, in terms of the germaneness to this bill. If we have any, if it's national or whatever, and
And maybe we can look into that and see if we can get it for you, great. If somebody's done that.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
very much. The suitcase.
Thank you.
John from OLCC and Mr. Hendricks, if you might be willing to join us for just a moment.
Wait a minute. We're doing PERS?
I thought we'd work in an update into the bill.
No more drinking. Anybody on PERS can't drink anymore.
Vacation from PERS.
So ordered. Mr. Hendricks.
Chair Deckard, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. How can I help you?
The question on the table was, can we link to the federal statute on this issue, and if not, why not?
The problem with linking to a federal statute, or for that matter to any outside publication or authority, federal rule, anything outside of the ORS itself, is that there's a string of Oregon cases that are very unequivocal that indicate that the only thing that Oregon can do in one of their statutes as far as incorporating another law or another document is bring that document in as that document exists at the time that the Oregon law becomes effective. And in other words, you can't pick up subsequent changes. You can't. Many of our statutes currently have language that is somewhat deceiving, in which it will talk about a federal statute and then it will say as amended. And there are many people who read that and think that means, well, it's however they amend it in the future is what we're incorporating, but the Oregon Constitution, and this is a delegation problem under Article 1, Section 21, we can't delegate to the feds the ability to basically control what our laws say. And so the problem with respect to this particular proposal is that the law right now governing what is a malt beverage or what isn't a malt beverage is pretty up in the air. The feds are going through rulemaking right now to basically try to clarify the situation. But if you lock it in right now, it's not clear to me what you've locked in. You may have locked in basically a determination that, in fact, these beverages are not... I think you probably walked in a determination that these beverages cannot be sold as malt beverages, because I think that's what the feds are concluding with respect to, for their purposes, whether or not they're malt beverages or not.
Thank you. You're free if you want to be. John?
Mr. Chair, members, good afternoon. John Steubenwald, Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I apologize for having to be in another part of the building until just a few moments ago, Mr. Chair, so I apologize, but I wasn't able to hear much of the previous testimony, so I'm frankly unaware of what you've discussed so far today. I'd be happy to respond to questions.
Questions for John, Senator Hannon.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Is the OLCC's intention to adopt any kind of rule or change any existing authority on these types of products?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, it's our advice from counsel that to continue the current situation of marketing this product in the state would require statutory change.
By whose definition? An AG is telling you this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, yes.
And what are they basing that upon? Because Mr. Hendricks just quoted Article 21, that the states have a right to control liquor or sale of products, and you're saying that the feds are telling you what you can and cannot do?
You know, Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, we became aware, late last year, we became aware of information from the federal government that the products as currently constituted would have problems meeting state law. It revolves around the state definition of malt beverage. Currently, that which the state defines as a malt beverage, beer, does not fit the definition of these products as they're currently on the market, in which lies the problem.
Mr. Chairman, if I can, have you indicated or have any knowledge of how much additional tax revenue this would generate for the state of Oregon if you were to collect this then through the OLCC versus over-the-counter in a grocery store?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I'm not sure whether we've done an analysis to that effect or not.
Does this interpretation have anything to do with revenue?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, no. I mean, per se, no. It's simply about the so-called alternative products not meeting the current state statutory definition of malt beverage.
Could a producer of this type of product reconstitute the drink to meet the requirement and still market the product on the shelves in grocery stores?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, theoretically I believe that's the case, yes.
Without your intervention?
Again, theoretically, I believe that's the case.
So we have a possibility of this bill, 871, or a House bill, 1 minute ago. Mm-hmm. There's a House bill that apparently is being enacted or is on its way over that holds everything in advance. What does that do?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, the House bill, which has been heard in committee, simply states in effect that beverages marketed today as malt beverages shall be allowed to continue to be marketed as malt beverages until
January 1st of next year.
So it in effect, doesn't solve the problem in the long term, but in effect buys some time.
Is this a manufacturer's dispute between the beer industry and the hard liquor industry?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I'm not sure I could really answer that question.
Well, you've been apprised of federal interpretation. I mean, somebody's got to have their nose out of joint to all of a sudden raise this issue. What precipitated this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, why that would choose to be called the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms initially did this study I'm honestly not sure.
Okay, thank you.
Paul, do you want to answer? Mr. Romain, you want to? Thank you. I had just one other question for you, John, when Paul comes up here. Can OLCC by rule ban products with 0.05 or less? Mr. Romain says no.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I believe the answer is no. If a product meets a legal, meets a statutory definition, we would, I don't believe, have authority to carte blanche across the board saying yet to a given product. Excuse my Russian.
We appreciate your Russian.
Well, it wasn't French.
That was Russian.
Senator,
can products that are less than 5% alcohol be sold in OLCC stores?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, no. The products sold in OLCC stores are distilled spirits, a distilled product.
With an alcohol limit greater than 5%.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, yes.
So this is, Mr. Chair, for these witnesses, so this product is really that product that's in nowhere land.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romain, for the record again. To answer a couple of your questions you threw out there, first of all, any product that has less than 0.5% alcohol in it is not considered alcohol for purposes of regulation in the state of Oregon. The reason for that is you would have the Orange Juice Regulation Commission, or the apple juice, fruit juice has alcohol in it. So there is no regulation of that product. There is a hole, in my opinion, in Oregon law between 0.5% and 5% distilled spirits, which is something I pointed out to the commission a year ago. I believe that there is no mechanism for distribution of any of this product, really, a strict reading of Oregon law, because the commission by statute has the authority to sell that which has 5% or more alcohol, but distilled spirits. Nobody has the authority to sell that which has more than 0.5% distilled spirits, but less than 5% distilled spirits. So it is the nowhere land product. My clients distribute this product now. We're asking you to take away our distribution rights. This goes against our economic interests. This is not self-serving on our part. We just don't think it's right stuff.
Mr. Roman, can you briefly address, very briefly, Senator Hannon's question?
On the alcohol.
How did we get here in terms of federal legislation?
Right. The state, against. Based on what I said before, the state determines that which can be distributed in the state. You can determine by rule or by law, actually by law, what you want to have distributed in the state. This issue came up, as I stated earlier, because there was a lot of scuttlebutt in the industry about what really is in this product. There was a lot of confusion because people weren't being given the straight answer about what was in the product. And when the OLCC determined after the BATF, or now TTB, studied the product, that most of the alcohol in this product, 75 to 90%, is from distilled spirits. Under Oregon law, they determined through the AG, has given them an opinion, that this cannot be distributed in grocery stores because it doesn't meet the definition of beer. It has nothing to do with the federal definition. Whatever the feds do, they could say that apple juice is beer. That's fine for federal purposes. It doesn't mean you at the state have to accept that definition. So whatever the feds do is almost irrelevant to you in the state of Oregon. You, right now, in the state of Oregon, have a definition of beer in the statute, malt beverage, which says fermentation of grain. And there's no provision for adding anything more to it. That's your dilemma. So your choices really are to change the definition of what is a beer, which we would oppose tremendously, to wait and see what the feds do, because that may kill the category nationally, because frankly, if they go to a 90-10, which they seem to be going to, it's going to require reformulation by everybody, and they will accept our definition. And that's frankly what the OLCC has done in their letter, which has that gone out? Yeah, went out today. They sent out a letter which says that you have till January 1 to remove the product from the shelf if it does not conform to the Oregon definition of beer, which means it has to have less than 0.5% distilled spirits.
Thank you.
I don't know if that helps you or hurts you or what.
Senator Hannon?
No, I don't know. I think we're fighting over a lot of big issues here. The state's going to hell in a handbasket. We're worried whether you buy punch or whether you buy beer. NyQuil is probably just as damning if you want to sit down and drink a bottle of NyQuil. So maybe we ought to regulate that, too.
If we could sell it, we could work out. Can we get exclusive territory?
40% by volume? Yeah.
Don't tell our previous panel, Mr. Our Senator Hannon. I think that was Senator Corcoran.
Well, John, it's my understanding that this came about because of a very precipitous act by the chair of OLCC that was other members of the commission were not even aware that there was this move to take this stuff off the shelves. You comment on that?
Ms. Chair, Senator Corcoran, no. Certainly this issue was discussed in public meetings before our Board of Commissioners. There was agreement that given the knowledge we received from what was then BATF, we had a legal definition problem of this product in our state, and the solution was to inform the industry that we have this problem and allow some time for a search for a solution.
Mr. Chair, if I may comment on that briefly,
yeah,
because we were involved with that. When the staff actually came was the one who informed the commissioners that they had a legal definition problem. They then proposed this letter, which I guess has gone out today. This was proposed a couple of months ago, and industry came in and commented on it. Some of the comments, for example, the original letter was going to go out and say you had till July 1 to take the stuff from the shelf, and we said, please give us at least till January 1 to take it from the shelf from an orderly market standpoint. The commission was extremely cooperative. They truly believe, and I happen to agree with them, that you have a definition problem in the state of Oregon. Whether you need to fix it or not is a separate question. But under Oregon law, beer is beer, and this is not beer. So it can't be put into the stores. I agree with the Liquor Control Commission's attorney who says you have a problem here. Your question is, do you do delay implementation of that? Do you change the definition? Do you absolutely nothing? That's the that's where you're paid the big bucks.
Thank you. I think
you gonna draft the NyQuil amendment or
got it, Mr. Nelson. And any other questions for Mr. Nelson and Greg Allstach?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, Public Affairs Counsel, representing Anheuser-Busch. I will try to make this as simple as I possibly can. The items that you saw in front of you have been determined that they are out of compliance with the statute. They have above a 0.05%. The OLCC says you must remove them from the stores. They have given until January 1 to remove them from the stores. And in their letter that they sent, they said, in order to comply with our state laws, we will require that any alternative product be removed from the licensee's shelves unless we receive documentation of the formulation proving the product is produced according to our malt beverage definition. Okay. They have to be removed from the shelves unless we show documentation that they have been reformulated. It is our intent to reformulate the product, to bring them under 0.05%. It is the intent of every other major brewer to do that by January 1. OLCC has said you must remove them or reformulate. We're going to reformulate. We don't think you need a bill at all, because we are going to bring the product in compliance with Oregon law and what we expect the federal law, although we don't have to follow that in this state, what the federal law will be, which they have announced, is again 0.05%. That's why there are other bigger issues in this that other people would like to bring in. There's another product called Rum and Coke, a single package drink, Rum and Coke. That is not part of these products. There are those who would like to bring that issue into this issue. We would like, of course, to keep that very separate. That is not what we're talking here. OLCC has said, we have discovered these products, small alternatives, do not fit 0.05%. Your formulation doesn't fit. Remove them from the shelves by January 1 or reformulate. We will reformulate. That's why we don't believe you need any legislation. Others may need other legislation for other issues, but we don't need it to deal with this problem.
Mr. Yates?
I guess just in terms of the confusion that's going on here, 0.05%. Now, how do you interpret that? 0.05%?
No. 0.5%.
Then it's 0.5%.
No, a percent is 0.01.
Okay, if you're going to talk about it as a decimal number, it's 0.005. If you talk about it as a percent, it's 0.5%.
0.5% would fit, yes.
Okay.
0.5%. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Very clear. Last, Mr. Allstosh. I apologize if I didn't get that right.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Gregory Altshue. It's German for old shoe.
Old shoe.
And I'm here today from Connecticut. I'm happy to be in your fine state. I have to say I'm from the state that just produced the national champion women's basketball team.
Sure.
I'm very proud of that.
Sure.
I'm also here, and more importantly, I'm here on behalf of the Flavored Malt Beverage Coalition, which is a coalition of companies that produce and market well over 50%, somewhere probably around 60-65% of the flavored malt beverages that are sold in this country. This coalition came together in August of last year simply to respond to the initiative that the federal government was talking about taking last summer. And it is still in existence, and it is representing these companies. It does not include the prior speaker. Anheuser-Busch is not a member of the coalition. Miller Brewing Company is not a member of the coalition. And Coors Brewing Company, which I think classify themselves as the senior members of the brewing industry in the country, are not members of this coalition. The coalition consists of small brewers, medium-sized brewers, and of other companies that have interest broadly in the beverage field that also now have interest in the brewing side of the business. And these companies have been, some of them since the 1980s, been producing flavored malt beverages, which are the products that we were talking about today. It's a subcategory of beers and malt beverages that has been around for decades. The federal government traces its records back to the 1940s when flavored beers were on the market. They're basically a malt beverage base with water, sugar, flavoring, coloring, carbon dioxide added. Typically alcohol content 4-5%. Some of you or your fathers may remember drinking cold duck or champagne. These are flavored malt beverages that were on the marketplace in the 1960s and the 1970s. All of these products, including the ones on the market today, have been approved. That is, their recipe, their formula, has been approved by the BATF, because BATF, federally speaking, must approve the formula for each one of these products. So they've known for many, many years what the ingredients are. But as some of you pointed out in your questions, the issue has become a hot-button one in the last year, and I think the question was asked why. Well, one reason I would suggest to you why is that the malt beverage industry, through its history, is a very competitive industry. When light beer was first being developed, There were great outspoken cries against it. When contract packing, where a third-party brewer produced beer for a second for the brand owner, was developed, there was great concern. It came from within the beer industry. And I think if you trace this one back, you'll find a lot of the concern about these products comes from within the beer industry. That being said, the issue in Oregon, I think, is one that does arise out of definitions. It does arise out of standards. This, and I won't enter it in the record, it's probably too big.
Please don't.
It's called the Adjunct Reference Manual. And what it is a federal government, ATF, sanctioned and beer industry approved manual that lists all the adjuncts, all the ingredients that can go into malt beverages and beers. And it's something that has evolved over a long period of time. About 23 years ago, ethyl alcohol in flavoring was added as one of the ingredients of this manual that the federal government and the brewing industry approved as an ingredient. And it's one of the ingredients that's been in flavored malt beverages and that has become the issue before us today. There are many other things, dozens of other ingredients that are in this manual that are in beers and malt beverages that aren't in the Oregon statute and aren't in the statutes of most states. And yet they're part of the fabric of malt beverages and have been for a long, long time. And you could go down the road of redefining or clarifying the definition of what is a beer, what should go in, what shouldn't go in. And I would suggest if you do that, you better pick up a copy of the manual and start down the list of chemicals and ingredients and foaming agents and preservatives and citric and on and on and on, because they're all in here. And they're in the beers that are in the stores in Oregon and the rest of the country today. It's just that a laser-like focus has been placed on one ingredient, the flavoring ingredient, in the products that we're talking about today. What's the best thing to do? I wouldn't presume to lecture you on Oregon law or the esteemed Mr. Romain, but it occurs to me, just looking at what I understand are the schedules and the timing, that the federal government has a rulemaking underway. It's announced in the notice of that rulemaking that it's considering the so-called 90-10 standard. It's also said that it's considering one that's called a 51% standard, and that it's open to any other standard anyone wants to suggest during the rulemaking process that's ongoing right now. That rulemaking process is probably going to go on until well into next year. The comment period closes now the end of June, and it's likely it'll be extended. I don't have inside knowledge. I just expect, based on having watched ATF operate for 25 years, that they'll probably extend the comment period for some period of time into the summer, July, maybe August. Then they'll take the comments behind the closed door. They'll study them. They'll evaluate them. Normally, this means that a specialist in the beer branch of the BATF will sit at a desk with a stack of thousands of emails, comments of whatsoever strike, and review them, and then come up with a proposal to take this forward to his boss and so far up the chain in the agency. The process, we've found in some industry matters, takes years. On this one, I think the federal government staff has indicated that they want to move it expeditiously. On this rulemaking that came out the end of March, they originally said they were going to put out the end of the summer, last summer. So we know things tend to slip a little. All I'm suggesting is that the process may take a little longer than everyone would like it to take, and I think it's likely to anticipate that it'll take until well into 2004 before the federal government publishes a rule as a final rule. And what the standard will be remains to be seen. They've indicated they feel the federal law supports a standard of 51% just as easily as it supports a standard of 90-10. And they're looking for the impact of that standard on the industry, because they've also said they don't want to kill this category. That being said, if you're looking for a way to address an issue in a way that's reasonable, one way to look at it would be to say, well, let's see what the feds do, because maybe there'll be some guidance there we decide we want to follow. We don't have to, but we could. In order to do that, you'll need to wait into 2004. I don't believe you're in session in 2004.
Oh, there's a good likelihood.
Well, you'd be the better judge of that, sir. But the one possibility would be to look to maintaining the status quo till would be the end of June of 2005, which
would... It sounds to me like we would have to direct the OLCC. Having done nothing, then this product would be eliminated by January 1st, is my understanding, unless we provide some direction to OLCC.
Based on the letter that Mr. Nelson, I think, just referred to, or Mr. Romaine, it would seem that something would need to be done. A placeholder that says maintain the status quo until pick a date, but a date that's reasonably far enough out to allow this rulemaking process federally to go forward.
And so is that your organization's position
that
you would prefer the legislature do that, given the uncertainty in the federal environment?
Well, we would certainly suggest that the OLCC do it, but at this point, it appears, based on the letter that we've just learned of, that they've decided that January 1 is an appropriate date.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Senator Starr. Just a couple of questions, Mr. Altshuler. As it relates to other states around the nation, are they dealing with this same issue? My guess is they likely are, and how are other states dealing with it, number one? And number two, Mr. Nelson's testimony said, you know, these guys are going to reconstitute the beverage to make them apply by law. What's right. the problem with that? Now, as far as it continue to provide the opportunity for Oregonians to purchase a product that's not exactly what it is today, but similar.
Yes, Senator Starr, Chair. The issue is one that has arisen in the minds of other state regulators in the alcohol beverage area. I've met with half a dozen different states, including Illinois, Maryland, Louisiana, Mississippi, among others. And the response I'm hearing is, well, we could, as a state, step in and re-regulate or revise our approach with respect to these products, or we can wait and see if there's a national solution and if that works for us. What I'm hearing is that a national solution seems to make a lot more sense, maybe not so much for legal reasons as for logical reasons. As a practical matter, if the federal government changes the standard for an alcohol beverage product, even though a state has a different standard, a company that's distributing a product in national distribution is probably going to live with and be forced to live with that national standard. To reformulate for multiple different markets creates a great deal of confusion and cost and diseconomies. So I think you'll find that many states simply decide, well, let's look to a federal standard for something like this, a product that's sold in interstate commerce where it does have a common name, and if there's a different version in each state, it becomes quite complicated. I'm sorry, your second question related to the 90-10 standard and reformulation. It's my understanding that what the Anheuser-Busch representative said today has been said elsewhere, and that is that products that their company makes in this category are going to be reformulated. Last summer, in response to the initial indication from the BATF that it was thinking of a different standard, the R&D people from all the members of the coalition I represent got together. They independently were directed by their managements to develop products that would meet the 90-10 standard. And they did that. And they went in and talked to the BATF and brought in existing products and reformulated 90-10 products, and allowed the ATF personnel to taste them and to look at them and the labs to evaluate them. The conclusion at that point, and that the group of people who produced those products had a combined R&D experience of 250 years in the industry. The result of that formulation was products that were frankly bad beer. They didn't taste like the products that consumers had been buying in fairly large quantities throughout the country today. Now, applying enough resources and enough technology and enough new art, perhaps you could reformulate a product at a different standard, at this rigid 90-10 standard, for example, that would taste just like the current one. At this point, my understanding is that it has not been accomplished. Now, that doesn't say that someone couldn't spend enough to do it. Whether in the long run that would make the category economical for a company to be involved in, that remains to be seen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Congratulations on your basketball team success.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
One last, Mr. Parker.
And we are quickly running out of time to get to two other bills.
I'll be real quick. My name is Jim Parker. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Brewers Guild, a nonprofit trade association representing 42 Oregon breweries, assorted wholesalers, suppliers to the beer industry, retailers, and enthusiasts. My point here is very simple. These products aren't beer. I'm actually glad Pamela Erickson brought in some to show you, because as someone who represents Oregon Brewers, I won't spend my money buying them to bring them here to show them to you. While it is true that some Oregon brewers do use flavorings in their beers, they use things like Oregon raspberries, Oregon spruce tips, Oregon heather tips, natural Oregon crops to make our product. I'm asking you, and I think I sent you all an email with all the federal proposals and everything that make it really clear. And if you read through their proposal, it's been mentioned before, out of the 114 that they studied, 105 had between 76 and 100% of their alcohol content from distilled spirits, not from fermentation. The life cycle of these products is much different than a beer. A beer, a brewer mashes grain, adds hops, ferments, and serves it. These, someone makes a malt base, runs it through a filter to remove any beer character, the alcohol that's developed by the fermentation, any color, and then they add flavoring, which is distilled spirits. If they were really malt beverages, maybe we'd see something like Widmer Blue, Full Sail Hard Cola, Bridgeport Ice. You don't see those. These are not beer products, and I think it would be a big mistake to blur the distinction between beer and other things. To put it another way, saying that these are flavored malt beverages would be akin to me saying that, well, this morning I had flavored V8 juice when instead I had a Bloody Mary. That's a difference between one beverage and another. And just to make one other point, Oregon law is very distinct and clear when it comes to what is beer and malt beverage and what isn't. There's actually a fermented grain beverage produced in the state of Oregon that's not considered beer, and that's sake. Sake is taxed and treated like a wine. It's not beer. These aren't beer.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Questions?
I have one. Would you be comfortable if us or OLCC extended that January 1st date basically to align with whatever the federal government does? And
just, I guess that's really not, I guess, something I'm comfortable or uncomfortable with. I think it'll all come out that the federal government will determine what can be called a flavored malt beverage. The law in Oregon says it has to be a brewed fermented beverage, and these aren't. So I don't know if I can discuss comfort levels with calling a duck a goose for another 6 months or another, 8 months or however long.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hannon.
Careful that now the Senator Duck is setting.
I don't want to call him a goose.
He's got duck, duck.
And one of my favorite watering holes is the wild duck.
Yeah. And they don't make these.
A club soda.
Yeah, that's right. The occasional club soda.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Farrelly.
Mr. Chairman, this has been a most interesting discussion. It appears to me that there is a technical change, an interpretive change, a statutory interpretation that creates what apparently is a meltdown crisis between marketers of different products. I believe the OLCC is probably right in their interpretation. We've heard testimony that the makers and distributors of a certain product will reformulate their product to bring their product in line with the definitional determination of the OLCC. I am convinced that if that's the case, then this technicality disappears. The thing that bothers me is that we're spending a lot of energy and time on this. The OLCC was prepared to have products withdrawn from the market that would be disruptive and expensive. I think that we will not be certain until the federal government rules on the technicalities, whether or not we need a statute. We may or may not be in the building at that time. It just seems that the folks that come to this committee unalterably opposed to the product are using exploiting the technology or the technical issue to press their opposition to the existence of the product. And I don't know whether that's persuasive testimony at all. I'm sitting here thinking that possibly the discussion that as long as the products are reformulated to meet with the OLCC's determination, there is no issue here.
I think it's a state's rights issue.
Mm-hmm. That, you know, the only concern I would have is that you've set this January 1st date the OLCC has, or at least in the letter that went out today, and I would just hate to see the disruption that may occur where you have maybe possibly reformulation of a product, then the feds ruled differently in, say, June, and you've had all of this disruption. It seems to me the way to go would be to just really get clarity with where the federal government's going to be on this and link to that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the other thing is, even if these products were supposedly or by some executive fiat ordered into liquor stores, there's no shelving. There's the size constraints. The whole idea of the, you want to talk about disruption, that would be very disruptive. They're not geared to marketing these kind of beverages. Mm-hmm. And the point is that these things do represent a growing market share. If somebody's buying them, that means there's some demand out there. I would just suggest that if we find any solution at all to this, it will be the one that avoids the disruption. Mm-hmm. And the expense of the disruption. Mm-hmm. We see a similar curve in the Department of Agriculture that has a new interpretation about political speech, and that's causing a meltdown in the commodity commissions. You know, and I guess these technicalities cause us all a lot of grief, but they're certainly expensive, and they're all done at the expense of the taxpayer. I see this as that kind of an issue.
Close. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 871. I'm going to try to get, committee, we're going to try to do both 807 and 344. Go with 344 next. Is Commissioner Beyer?
He is. He's right outside.
Is he here?
Having a beer.
Yeah, we can all
I'll be right out.
Test these right products now. This evening and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 344. We're a little bit short on time. My intention was really an email exchange I had with Senator Beyer, or former Senator Beyer, on this issue. I want to give it first to Senator Corcoran.
Okay.
To introduce the bill and then use this bill also as a vehicle to discuss Commissioner Beyer's email. Senator Corcoran.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity, Senator, to have a brief discussion at least about what precipitated this bill in the first place. And it's pretty well laid out in the preamble in the bill itself. We have two folks. I've invited Professor Doppel from the 3 p.m. program at the University of Oregon and Chuck Sheketoff from the Oregon Center for Public Policy to make some comments. Mr. Doppelt and Mr. Sheketoff helped me develop this perennial bill. It could never get a hearing in previous years, so I appreciate the opportunity to at least have a brief discussion, and I recognize that you're going to want to move this bill potentially in a different direction. I think that the issue of corporate disclosure becomes more critical in these economic times when we are faced with the situation of two-thirds of the corporations in Oregon paying only the minimal fee. I think that it begs the question of why shouldn't we know, if we can know at a federal level what they pay if they're publicly traded, why shouldn't we know what they pay at the state level? So with that, I'll just bring up Mr. Doppelt and Mr. Sheketoff. Mr. Doppelt had amendments to this bill. While he's coming up, I'll just tell you that ran into a problem with Ted Ruttlinger in Legislative Council regarding trying to move past the relating clause that exists in the bill, and I'll let Mr. Doppelt in his comments talk about that. And I'm also going to ask Mr. Doppelt to talk to us briefly about the experience of other states, because it's always enlightening to hear what other states are doing in this regard. So, that'll shut up.
Good afternoon. Thank you for being with us. And this is somewhat unfair due to the length of our previous hearings, but I don't know if it's possible to do the presentation in 10 minutes. Is that fair? Or?
I'm going to take no more than 5 minutes.
No problem.
Chuck Chekhov has never taken more than five minutes.
He's succinct.
But he's like Peter DeFazio. He can do about 2 hours in 5 minutes.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you for taking the time, and Senator Corcoran. My name is Bob Doppel. For the record, I direct the Program for Watershed and Community Health, which is a sustainable development technical assistance and research institute affiliated with the Institute for Sustainable Environment at the University of Oregon and the 3PM program. I want to make it clear I'm not representing the university today. I'm here representing just myself. I'm here today to inform you of an issue that I think really deserves your utmost attention, and that is the need for the Oregon Investment Council to require full disclosure of environmental, product, and labor and community-related liabilities by corporations that PERS invests in. As Senator Corcoran said, while not technically germane to Senate Bill 344, this issue is very germane to the need to resolve issues that threaten the viability of PERS and to corporate disclosure issues in general. We all know that PERS faces a serious budget shortfall, and as steps are taken to resolve this issue, it only makes sense to address and prevent other risks to the value of the PERS investment portfolio. Through my work, and I spent a lot of time working with companies on governance issues, it's become very clear that there is a significant risk to PERS because many companies do not fully disclose their environmental, product, and community and labor-related liabilities to the Securities and Exchange Commission, as required by law, and to potential investors. Oregon PERS should invest in companies that have the greatest potential for strong, sustainable returns. Companies that do not fully disclose their liabilities are likely to encounter major financial problems in the future and should therefore undergo extra scrutiny before investments are made in them. Environmental liabilities such as brownfield contamination and even exposure to the risks of climate change, liabilities from defective products, and those related to labor relations problems are bottom-line issues for companies and investors. Companies that leave these liabilities off the books are hiding major financial costs that may affect the value of their stock. Despite the SEC's directives requiring full disclosure, research has shown that perhaps no more than 15 to 20% of U.S. corporations fully disclose their material, environmental, product liability, and labor-related liabilities. When unreported liabilities come to light, the stock value can often dramatically and rapidly tumble. For example, in Detroit, Michigan, in 1999, U.S. Liquids Corporation was found to be illegally dumping cancer-causing hazardous waste into the sewer system. This revelation caused a 58% drop in U.S. liquid stock prices in 1 week and a 110% drop in annual revenue. The drop in value prompted a securities class action suit and a derivatives action by shareholders against the company. And there are many other examples of this kind of issue coming to light. The failure to disclose environmental, product, and labor and community-related liabilities makes it impossible for the Oregon Investment Council and the analysts that they hire to manage the PERS account to accurately assess a company's assets and liabilities. This is a similar issue in a different form to the problems that Enron showed and WorldCom. The liabilities are simply being kept off the books. I'm not going to go into the rest of the details. We can deal with this question and answer, but I will say that the states of Vermont, the state treasurers in Vermont and Kentucky and New York, as well as the controllers in the city of New York and others, have announced that they are very concerned about this issue. They're actually calling a summit on this issue of state treasurers to be held fairly soon. And it seems to me that this is an issue that Oregon needs to take a look at very quickly and to also be a part of. Oregon State Representative Phil Barnhart has introduced HB 3191, which provides a means to address this issue. I don't think it's going to get a hearing, but this is the bill if you haven't seen it. I think it can be used as a model for how to address this issue, or at least as a starting point for discussion. So in closing, let me say that I urge the committee to give immediate and serious attention to this issue. This is a bottom-line revenue issue for the state of Oregon and for PERS. If the other state treasurers are involved, then it certainly behooves the state of Oregon to be involved, and I stand ready to assist the committee and others to address this issue in any way that I can. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chuck Shekatoff, the Oregon Center for Public Policy, here in support of Senate Bill 344. Senate Bill 344 is a simple bill. It says, disclose your profits, taxable profits, attributable to, apportionable to Oregon, and tell us your taxes, and we'll see which companies are paying the full 6.6% and which aren't. As noted in the bill, and as I previously testified, two-thirds of Oregon's C corporations pay the $10 minimum tax that was set in 1931. It was originally $25 in 1929, and then the benevolent 31 legislature lowered it after the stock market crash in the beginning of the Great Depression, where it's sat ever since. The bill would sort of go, is modeled on what you can get, information you can get at the federal level for publicly traded corporations through filings with the, primarily with the Securities and Exchange Commission. In the early 80s, Citizens for Tax Justice did reports and that on how General Electric, for instance, was paying no taxes, had a negative income tax, despite billions in profits. And that led to the 1986 reforms that Senator Packwood put through that changed that. So a few years later, only a few of the companies that CTJ had reported paid no income taxes were now paying taxes. 2.5 years ago, the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, their 501c3, released an updated report, Corporate Income Taxes in the 1990s, and it again showed a number of the 250 large corporations, and it showed a number of companies weren't paying taxes and or had disparities. And I think that's one of the key issues. It looks at disparities between industries or within industries, and would also help you in targeting economic development for the state. So, for instance, in the pharmaceutical industry, and this is a report that looked at federal taxes at 96, 97, and 98 and has three-year totals. So, for instance, in 1998, Pfizer Corporation, with a profit of $1.2 billion, had a negative income tax of 16.5% versus the federal corporate 35%. On the other hand, Abbott Laboratories paid 26.7%. in income taxes. If you're going to do economic development, which company would you try to woo to Oregon? You'd think you'd maybe buy a company that pays better foreign taxes. Or you look at in wholesale and retail trade. Saks had a minus 9.5% tax rate in 1998 on a profit of $83 million, while Nordstrom and Federated Department Stores paid essentially the full 35% federal corporate income tax on their profits. So if you're going to build a department store in a complex and do tax increment financing and bring someone in, do you bring in a Saks or do you bring in a number of Nordstrom's or another one of Federated Department Stores companies? Disparity between Safeway. Safeway's taxes were 24.2% over the three-year period. Winn-Dixie was 35%. Albertsons was 33%. So it can help you show the disparities within the industries. The companies, the SEC has shown they've given up their right to privacy, and they don't, unlike us, corporations exist at the pleasure of this legislature and other legislatures. And there's no competition issues. This is old information. It's not going to help a company with any competitive advantage. In fact, if one industry is seen as having a low tax rate as an industry in this state, it might attract businesses to come here because it would look like we're favorable to that industry. At a previous hearing on the other side, the House Revenue Committee, Associated Oregon Industries responded to this and saying, majority of these corporations are now defunct, small businesses with no presence, they do not have a nexus, and many of these corporations simply didn't make any money. the ones that are paying the minimum tax. Well, some didn't make money, but not all of them. A lot of them are not paying taxes because of the multiple-year carry-forwards. Just look at Associated Oregon Industries' proposal for an expansion of the research and development tax credit, where they want a 20-year carry-forward. That's saying to you, we think there's going to be some companies that need 19 years of tax freedom, 19 or 20 years of tax freedom. The unemployed worker pays a lot more in taxes on his or her unemployment insurance than the $10 minimum. I think it would aid in economic development, it would aid in the business climate, and it would be a positive step forward for bringing about accountability and to both corporations and to the tax system in Oregon. Sunshine, as one Supreme Court justice said many years ago, sunshine's the best disinfectant, and this would promote that public confidence both in corporations and in government tax policy that people are treated fairly, knowing that some companies aren't paying taxes and are paying more than the typical Oregonian is troubling.
Thank you very much. Senator Hannah.
Ms. Shackenhoff, I support sunshine. As a matter of fact, I support it on nonprofit organizations as well. I think it's good to show what kind of money you're getting, how you're spending it, and how you're meeting the tax code, because I think a lot of organizations set themselves up under an umbrella, and they protect themselves, but when it comes to other people, we got to shine the light in. So let's shine the light in on everybody. You know, I think if we're going to disclose this, then I'll disclose you my income tax. You disclose me your income tax. Let's open the books on everybody. You know, hey, let's just open this up. It's a free game. Let's just open the books up to everybody. Nobody hides. Let's shine the light. I believe. Amen. Shine the light.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon, 501c3 corporations' tax returns are fully disclosed. We're required as a matter of federal law to disclose them. We have obligations under federal law to respond to a request to see them and to provide copies. Anyone who contacts our office is given them immediately. We typically don't charge for the copies. We also have a web address for them. I can't remember the form number. I think it's a 990. I get confused on IRS forms. But we are required to disclose our federal and state tax forms, and a lot of that information is in there. All 501c3s have to do that. And I would just say that I think there is a difference between corporations and individuals, and these corporations are disclosing at the federal level. If you look at the Citizens for Tax Justice, looked at all the companies, of their 250 companies in here, they were able to figure out what their gross state income tax liability was for 237 of them from their SEC filings. And their average state income taxes they paid were 3.8% of profits. Okay? Well, the weighted average for those states was about twice that much as far as the tax rates. So what it showed was they're all paying about half on average, paying on half of what the state income tax, corporate income tax rates are. States are losing money. And who suffers from this? All taxpayers do, because it's a simple mathematical truism that when there's declining corporate taxes, that the public pays more or gets less. It's just mathematically true. And that's what this gets at. And it doesn't raise anyone's taxes. It just gives you a better decision. You know, when you go to deal with the tax bill and a company up here says, oh, this is going to put us out of business, going to make it hard for us to expand on all that, you don't know their tax liability. Your staff does. Department of Revenue does. They're entitled to the confidential information. But you don't know whether that company has carry-forward credits up the wazoo that they won't be paying taxes for 10 years and never have, or whether they are truly paying the full 6.6%. What this lets you know is whether or not who's paying a lot and the competition. I think of it, you look at the difference in grocery store chains, Albertsons versus Safeway and Winn-Dixie, how does that relate to Orville Roth's chain here in the Valley? Is an Oregon-grown company paying unfairly disadvantaged through our tax code? I don't know. This would support that. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, Reverend Hannon missed your
I'm sorry he did as well.
Your answer.
I'm sure he's been praying for you right now.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Lee, do you have just a second to let the opponents come up of this, and then we'll get to the PUC issue. Joe?
Reverend Hannon is pretty good.
Pretty good for a young kid. He's still from sense of humor. Never seen such disrespect of one's elders.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Schweinhardt from Associated Oregon Industries. I have with me today Alan Apodaca from J.C. Penney, who I would like to have give his comments first, and then I'll have a few comments to make. Okay. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. Again, my name is Alan Apodaca. I'm the store manager here at J.C. Penney here in Salem, Oregon. I'm speaking on behalf of J.C. Penney and the store managers here in the state of Oregon. J.C. Penney has been in the state of Oregon since 1911 when we opened up our first Pendleton store. We've been here in Salem since 1917. Currently, we operate 14 stores in the state of Oregon and employ over 1,100 Oregon citizens. I'd like to give you some talking points on Oregon Senate Bill 344, if I could. First off, we don't feel that this bill is the solution to the perceived problem, that public disclosure of tax liability information does not address the problems that are listed in Section 2 of the bill. The Department of Revenue and its auditors really address these non-compliance tax of tax laws, and that public disclosure is not really a compliance tool. Public disclosure of tax liability information will not lead to, as Section 2.14 of the bill indicates, to better analysis and development of appropriate and sound tax policy for Oregon. We feel that really the Department of Revenue is a better resource for this. They already have the information that folks are looking for. They can use this information to make the right conclusions and do it all without public disclosure. Secondly, implementing public disclosure of tax liability information would cause undue hardship or extended hardship of the state and the taxpayers. Right now, we all know that we're in a tough economic times. This bill would most likely bring additional administrative costs without bringing additional revenue to the state. In addition, disclosure of certain tax information would reveal proprietary trade secrets to competitors. Disclosure requirements would put Oregon at a disadvantage with business compared to other states that do not have these type of requirements. Thirdly, confidentiality of taxpayer information is a basic principle of tax policy. Confidential information encourages compliance through the flow of information between the Department of Revenue and the taxpayer. It ensures that they're accurate tax liability calculations. And my understanding right now is that the state of Oregon has an agreement with the IRS for an exchange of this type of information if they need that information. Those are the points that we have from J.C. Penney. I know you're pressed for time here. So, in conclusion, you know, we are concerned. We are a concerned citizen of the state of Oregon, a corporate citizen. We've paid hundreds of thousands of dollars in state and local taxes here. We continue to provide additional contributions to the communities of Oregon through our J.C. Penney after school programs. Last year, we contributed $34,000 to the different communities in Oregon. Through contributions to the YMCA and the Boys and Girls Clubs. And, of course, those type of contributions would always continue. We feel that we're obligated to be a good corporate citizen, and this bill would not change any of that. Appreciate you letting me have a little time to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Joe, did you have anything
to add? Yes, just a few more things.
Before we do, Mr. Chair, can I ask Mr. Apodaca a question?
Sure.
Well, first of all, thank you for assuring us, you know, that you're a good corporate citizen. I mean, and from the contributions you make, that appears to be the case. But the question I would have is, when you say that you pay thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars in state and local taxes in Oregon, does that put J.C. Penney in the category of the one-third that do or the two-thirds that don't pay the excise tax, corporate excise tax?
I don't have that information. I would assume we're...
Okay. Thank you.
The thing about it, though, is the Department of Revenue would have information or access to information to determine if we are compliant. So,
right, Mr. Chair, I guess my point is, in reading your talking points, that the one thing that you leave out is that it would be very obviously of interest to know in some form who pays and who doesn't and for what reasons. I mean, if you're not selling a product, then you're not going to pay an income tax. That's pretty obvious. But it would guide us in terms of some of our views of some of the corporate tax breaks that we do create. And I think for that reason alone would be valuable.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you. I was just wondering, on your confidentiality issue, what is it about disclosing your tax liability would reveal proprietary information?
Well, I think we give additional specific information, perhaps about the state of Oregon and our business here. You know, we disclose all this on a federal level. So that information is out there. More specific information is not. And this bill might have that information, which could put us or anyone out there at maybe some kind of disadvantage because of the information that's released.
Well, Mr.
Based
Chair.
On sales and other things that we have locally.
Senator Ringer.
My understanding is this bill would just require that you disclose the tax liability. Isn't that right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, I think the bill says tax liability and other information, related information. Then that book that's in the bill.
Tax liability and income.
Yeah, just
income. Okay, so
related information.
So what
related
is
information? Yeah, it says it right here.
And what line are you looking at?
In the summary and second, in the second paragraph, second sentence, for a certain corporation to file statement contain tax liability and related information.
I'm sorry, what line are you looking at?
In the summary of the bill.
Okay, but I'm looking at the language itself. For example, line 10 says disclosure of the federal tax liability.
That's line 10 or point 10? That's section 2.
Right.
Section.
The discrepancy
section
here.
Yeah, I was going to say in the summary it says related information.
I'm just asking where in the bill you're looking at, though.
Yeah, we were just looking at the summary.
I only have a copy of the summary. It's in
It's 26, page 2, line 26.
All right.
Sorry about that.
I'm just wondering whether you would be more comfortable with a bill if it were more circumscribed than if you want to delete the words related information. Frankly, I think that's too ambiguous, but just so that it contained the information on the tax liability. I don't see what's proprietary about somebody's tax liability. I don't see how that discloses any confidentiality.
There's just the potential to have that information out there and to have it in a different sense than what we have it out there now. I think that the basis of this bill is that public disclosure of this liability will not allow or would not make corporations adhere any differently to what's going on. Those type of tax liability issues are already being addressed by the Department of Revenue.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr. Or Senator Ringo.
One of us.
Or Senator Ringo.
No,
I
understand that. I understand that point. I understand that you don't disclose the information now. You'd really rather not disclose it. But it still doesn't seem to me you've made a good case for why it's proprietary and that releasing that would cause you damage in some sort of a specific way.
Again, Senator, I don't have all the specifics on exactly what information would be released, but I know that additional information for competitors, and I'm not just speaking for JCPenney, but our competitors would be at the same disadvantage of allowing their information to be viewed by us or by anyone out there to just make more specific decisions, perhaps competitive decisions that might take advantage of things that we wouldn't normally know or have privy to.
Joe, does any other state in the nation require this?
No, Mr. Chairman, as far as I know, they do not. I think that the statement was made, there are other states looking at the same type of issues, but no states, to my knowledge, do it.
Senator Starr.
Mr. Chair, I as somebody who's a investor in mutual funds and direct stock and companies that do business in in and around the United States, there's a lot of information that's available via a company's regular filings with the SEC and all of these kinds of documents that they're required to file as a publicly traded corporation. I could see the value of a competitor knowing how much taxes a specific company is paying in a particular state, and using that information as in combination with other public health information, and devising ways to use that as to competitive advantage or disadvantage to the company that's required to provide the information. I'm not going to sit up here and tell Oregon companies, folks that are doing business in Oregon, that they've got to reveal proprietary information and put them at a significant disadvantage to their competitors that might be doing business in Oregon or in Washington, Idaho, California, and states that surround us. I'm not thinking that this is a very good idea, Mr. Chair.
But Mr. Chair, where is that request for proprietary information? That's not in the bill.
I would suggest, Mr. Senator, that you have the requirement that they tell you how much taxes they're paying or not paying. That's proprietary information, in combination with other required information that these corporations already have to submit. The opportunity to draw linkages and lines and conclusions, I think, is very, very, very much in the realm of possibilities with these competitors. You can't look at Oregon as a vacuum. As it relates to how these corporations don't just operate in Oregon. And I think we're walking on really shaky ground here when we head down this direction. That's putting Oregon companies and Oregon jobs at risk.
Hmm. Senator Farrell.
That's required.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's a number of things that sort of strike me about this issue. First of all, I heard somebody say that there's non-disclosure of this information. There isn't non-disclosure of this information. There's every appropriate disclosure of this information. Department of Revenue has acres of files that are filed every year by corporations in Oregon. As a matter of fact, our tax system is bizarre, and it's Byzantine in its complexity. We have a whole enforcement division at the Department of Revenue that does nothing but sift through these documents for accuracy and completion and completeness. If they're not accurate and they're not complete, believe me, the CEOs and their financial folks hear about that. That is public disclosure. It is disclosure to a public entity. But it's simply not published public disclosure. And that information is privileged information for a reason. And, you know, it may be of a concern to people in the business world that it's not disclosed to their competitors, but ought to be chillingly concerning to individuals. Elected public officials have to file their statements of economic interest. As a matter of fact, they're due April 15th every year. No coincidence there. But yesterday, a memorandum was floating around my office from people that were very concerned that you could click on a telephone number and use a search engine and find a map to the individual residence that was indicated by the telephone. And the concern that I heard expressed by legislators about their personal security leads me to believe people don't like disclosure of personal information, even if it might be public. And especially to connect the dots because of purposes that people might have that aren't beneficial purposes. And that's the danger I see here. It's not necessarily about competitiveness. It's about the information might be used for purposes that are not good purposes and have no public purpose. We have the unitary tax law. We chase people all over 50 states with a briefcase and a net, and we make them disclose their corporate sales in Oregon and the origination of sales in Oregon and the percentages of their overall businesses that can be attributable to Oregon, and then we bill them for that. That's disclosure, and it's public disclosure. The Department of Justice has access to any of these records anytime they think that a corporation's crossed the line to tax avoidance, which is perfectly legal, into tax evasion, which is actionable, and usually will get you making license plates if they can prove it. That's why we have an enforcement division at the Department of Revenue. There's a time-honored tradition, and that is tax filings are confidential, and they're confidential because to release a piece of that information or a portion of that information without context, and you cannot release enough information out of those tax files without nearly releasing everything to get context. So let's play this issue out. supposing a big corporation which has investments that are depreciable and which makes charitable contributions and donations zeroes out its tax liability for a particular year. Should that make that corporation the subject of public scorn and ridicule and possibly a change in their demand pattern because they've used our tax system legally to avoid payment of taxes, which is reasonable and legal and authorized? Or should we take the broader view and indicate that we have a rate of taxation, we have a tax structure? I'm sensitive to Senator Corcoran's concern, and that is that we're giving away too much money out the back door in tax credits. And some corporations seem to be able to avoid paying what he would argue, I think, is the fair share. But disclosing a piece of tax information or portions of tax information out of context, publishing that information, simply makes those corporations potential targets for a public action that may be wholly inappropriate. And we're never going to, I don't think we should go down that slippery slope of starting to disclose because people will want more and more information. And what eventually happens there is that you end up with full disclosure. And I just think that then why not disclose personal tax information on every citizen in the state of Oregon? So I guess I see a good public purpose in the intention here. But I do not think that the vehicle of requiring corporations to disclose pieces and parts without context, which might subject them to public action that's inappropriate, I don't think that's good public policy, Mr. Chairman, for all the reasons that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, I have no strong feelings about the bill. I think it's a great bill.
Why is it good federal policy and not good state policy, Senator?
Didn't we just disconnect from the federal tax code, Senator?
Was that an answer?
I think so. State and federal policy differ. Often.
Joe, did you have...
Just a few minutes, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I wanted to address the investment issue. First of all, I think you can go to any competent investment banker or counsel and find out most anything you want about a company, whether it's a good investment. And when you talk PERS, obviously when the market wasn't down, the market was doing well, PERS was making a tremendous amount of money, so they knew how to invest money. It wasn't a question of knowing what company was good and what wasn't. They were making very good money. The investment council did real well. I think this is just an invasion of privacy. These are not public companies. Their earnings are taxed. And why would any company in Oregon come to incorporate in Oregon? It's just another disincentive of doing business in Oregon, something we don't need. Not only that, but the business would hurt smaller, traditional industries in Oregon, family businesses that don't have any stockholders. And we just think this is a bad bill and should be defeated and opposed.
Appreciate it. I don't know if Lee Beyer is still here. The committee is not. Thank you very much. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
You've got me, Commissioner.
You left everybody else.
Everyone else is, I want to, for Senate Bill 807, I'd like to go ahead and do it so that we have it in play. Senator Beyer, you'd brought up some points related to this topic. I've certainly followed the PUC hearings on the PGE Enron case. If you may just brief me and Liz Beth.
By all means, Mr. Chair, I'm here at your request, so I'd be happy to discuss this with you. For the record, I'm Lee Beyer, Commissioner with the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and I should say that my comments are my comments. They're not those of the Commission, necessarily. This issue of, I referred to it as disconnecting from the consolidated tax form filing, came up as I watched the legislature try to deal with the fiscal issues that you have in front of you this year, and as we dealt with in the PUC the issues, at least the public perception of whether one of our utilities is paying its taxes or not. I should say for the record that the issue really has been in the paper. No secret here is that PGE has claimed they have paid their appropriate taxes to their owner, which is Enron Corporation,
and the allegation is that Enron, in turn, has not paid taxes in Oregon. For the record to be very clear, I do not know whether that is true or not, because that information is confidential and is held only by the Department of Revenue. For rate-making purposes, it makes no difference. The rate-making process, which has over 100 years of tradition, is on a forward-looking basis. We build a record based on what the utility builds a record, and we agree with that or whatever, based on a forward-looking curve of what their costs are going to be, and given those costs, what a reasonable return would be. Part of those costs are taxes, so that's in there. From that regard, the rates that are set have assumed that taxes will be paid. Whether they are or not is different. The concern I brought to the chair's attention had to do with, given that structure where you're connecting on a consolidated basis, you're looking at, in this example, a corporation that literally has hundreds of subsidiary companies scattered across the United States and, for that matter, across the world, although our unitary tax doesn't deal with the world, only the United States. The issue is, does that structure, by allowing a consolidated tax, capture the appropriate amount of taxes in Oregon? I don't know what the answer to that is. I think that, as you look at tax policy, is worth looking at. After I corresponded with you, I did have a chance to talk briefly with both Mr. Warner and with representatives of the Department of Revenue, who are frankly much better able to address this issue than I am. They surprisingly told me that the reason Oregon went to a consolidated return was the fear that by not doing that, we were not capturing our fair share of revenue. So it's the other side of the question, that we do better through a consolidated return. And it was all part of apparently about the same time of when Oregon, you may not remember, maybe before you were worrying about these things, Senator Deckard, but in the early 80s, Governor Attia at that point pass-through was called the uniform or not unitary tax system, which is a very big issue to predominantly Asian countries in terms of whether they were going to invest in the United States or not. And Oregon changed, was at the lead of changing that tax policy. It's called Water's Edge policy, and as a result of that, received a lot of investment in the state. But I think it's timely. I think as you look at your tax policy, it's something you ought to look at. I think there are tax experts who can converse with you much better than I can about that, but certainly the issues that I'm sure you've heard about with respect to the utility and rate making, I don't think bear directly on this. It's very emotional for many people, but it really isn't a bearing on the tax policy per se.
So what you heard, Mr. Beyer, was that at least subsequent to the conversation or the correspondence that we had, is that at least the department suggested that the consolidated approach is an approach that they feel is one that will actually reap or help solve just the situation that I had inquired about.
That's my understanding, that on the whole, you know, when you look at it, that we're likely to get more revenue that way through a consolidated return than through separate returns. And again, I would encourage you to talk with them about that.
Okay, thanks. I'd like to follow up on that. Thank you very much.
It's nice being back in front of the Revenue Committee.
Yeah, this is your old home.
You have those exciting discussions about malt beverages.
Why that isn't the Revenue Committee? Well, it's such a revenue issue for Oregon.
Sure it is.
Thank you, Mr.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your patience. I'm going to close the public hearing. The Department of Revenue, Deborah or Don, did you guys have anything that really has to be on the record, or... You can talk to me afterwards when I get these. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 344. I want to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 807. Y'all have been very patient today, and this is the only way by having a hearing is to keep this bill open for action. Do you want to come up, Louie? Roger, do you want to testify? Michael, come on up. Yes, sir.
All right. Chair Deckard, committee, thank you.
For the record, my name is Louis Pitt, Jr. I'm Director of Government Affairs and Planning for the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon. I do live in Warm Springs, the home of most of our tribal members, 4,200-member tribe. The Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs strongly support Senate Bill 807 to help meet the critical need for school facilities on our reservation. The old Warm Springs Elementary School is unsafe and overcrowded and must be replaced. To give you an idea of how old it is, I attended school there. It was up until the second grade. It was old then. As part of the Madras 509J school district, our reservation relies on increasingly uncertain school funding. The tribes receive no federal dollars for K through 12 education. Pardon me. To ensure construction of a new elementary school, the tribes made an agreement with the school district 2 years ago to pay one half of the cost of construction of a new elementary school. With each school budget cut, however, the construction schedule is delayed. Warm Springs faces a deep crisis in education. The dropout rate is well over 20%. Just the other day, I heard the middle school attendance was 71%. So, and again, it's just one of those things we keep pushing. Day before was 78%. Not very good. Weather's getting good, apparently, on the reservation. To leave the reservation for schooling means 3 hours on a school bus for many of our children. A potential new funding source for school construction is revenue bonds backed by impact aid monies from Congress. Impact aid is provided to school districts that serve Indian reservations or military bases. The amount is based on the number of students living on the reservation or base because their parents do not pay property or other taxes that support the local schools. Senate Bill 807 simply authorizes a school district to issue revenue bonds backed by federal impact aid dollars. The Dash 1 Amendment, which the tribes support, requires the district and the tribe to enter into an agreement for the use of the bond revenue before the bonds may be issued. The bonds would be used to fund capital improvements to public school buildings on these Indian reservations. We recognize that in tight budget times, we are unlikely to see impact aid dollars used to back bonds. But we need all the tools, and this is the key, we need another tool here, at our disposal to address the current crisis in school facilities. And if Senate Bill 807 helps the 509J school district keep its commitment to an adequate elementary school for the students on the Warm Springs Reservation, your work in passing it will be well worth it. You are aware, Mr. Chairman, of the importance of education to our people. You're very well, we're very involved in the passage of Senate Bill 690, our Native American teacher bill, last session. Without decent facilities for education, our very survival as Wasco, Warm Springs, and Paiute peoples is threatened. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 807. The Confederated Tribes support the bill. Good bill, do pass. We heard just before this meeting and meeting with somebody that knows more about how to support school construction that, you know, maybe we should be looking at not only bonds, but what was the call, Michael?
Notes for the record, Chair Deckard, Michael Mason. But we were talking with John Marshall, who, of course, you know, has signed up to testify, and I don't want to speak for him, but I can say that, and I'm sure he'll tell you that he endorsed the Dash 1 amendments and okay. Also had some ideas, but we can work on improvements on the House side rather than bring those to you. Right,
what you'd like to do? I mean, my intention would be bring this bill back next week for a work session. I'd ask that y'all get the committee members and just at least brief them. It seems like a very good idea and an important bill that we need to pass. So what I'd like to do is maybe bring this back Tuesday or Wednesday of next week just to work it and move it, unless you prefer to work on it or if that buys you some time as it goes over to the House to explore whatever options that you may have in terms of expanding.
Well, I think at this point, Chair Deckard, we'd be fine with just going with the Dash 1 amendments.
And okay. Buy you some time and then...
Yeah.
So if you can check with the other members, just make sure they're good and
okay.
We'll reschedule this.
We'll do that. I'm sorry. Could I add one little brief thing? And that's that wanted just to clarify or make it absolutely clear that the tribe doesn't receive any federal dollars. That was in Mr. Pitt's testimony. But also the Bureau of Indian Affairs doesn't do anything directly and hasn't since 1960 regarding K through 12 education on the reservation. So
great.
That point.
Thank you very much. How's your golf game, Louie?
Good.
Good. Weather's good for
her. Yeah.
Roger, you're free to make fun of my neckwear on this day. Mr. Chairman,
I just wanted to point out that, you know, if you wear a regimental tie, this one's the right color, which you appreciate.
Especially today.
I do have a tie on, too, Mr. Chairman. Just for the record, I'm Roger Martin. I represent the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. Louis handled this very well, but let me just point out, we did have a conversation with John Marshall. He does support what we're talking about. He produced for us a list of the school districts in the state that received these federal impact funds. It might help you to understand that historically, after the end of the Second World War and the tremendous increase in military bases in the western part of the United States, the congressman from the western part of the United States said, we need some help, and federal impact funds were set in motion, both for to make up for military reservations, of which I think we have none anymore, and Indian reservations. School districts, I think, have looked at them and, hey, this is our way of getting a little money out of those reservations, but they haven't dedicated the money to use. It's the great aspiration of the Confederate Tribes of the Umatilla to build a school or charter school on our reservation. School attendance, the dropout rate that we talked about, is an ever troubling problem that all the tribes are working with, and in our case probably our reservation has three different school districts depending on where you live on the reservation. You go to Pendleton to Ukiah. Kids drop out badly, and if we could ever get a handle on this, it would be wonderful in getting them well educated. And I'll do what you suggest, Mr. Chairman, talk to the other members.
Yeah, let's see. John's in here. Let's see what options we have. I guess we'll just, so if you guys divide up the members, we'll move it along next week, provided that they're good to go. And then my feeling would be, let's get all the options we can together and put them in one bill on the House side. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Marshall, did you want to add anything? Or? Okay, great. We'll come back to it in a work session next week. Appreciate your patience. We went long. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 807. Adjourn.